where we are met with cynicism and doubt, and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Yes, 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 it's time. We all come together. Aha! Barack Obama!
Yes, we can, yes!
Barack Obama!
We all can,
Barack Obama! Yeah, 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 Barack Obama! Oh! Barack Obama's making history, man. He's coming with a message for the people saying, yes, we can, sure! Si se puede, today is a new day. So come on and throw your hands up, every woman, every man. Barack Obama!
Yes, we can,
Barack Obama!
We all can,
Barack Obama! Yeah, 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 Barack Obama! It's wrong!
A million facts of a new crowd, a million steps in a new route. The acting out of the possible is still better than the futile. Political change, political pain, all in attempt to embellish the reign of a power to the people, so that we can develop a sequel. For living in love for peace, for pushing the envelope, honoring all of the work, paying attention to reason, dipping our feet and dipping the moderate work, teaching minds of a new height, seeking signs of a new life. This is the meaning of outreach, when it's out of reach, we still
Barack Obama.
Yes, we can,
Barack Obama.
We all can,
Barack Obama. Yeah, 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 Barack Obama. Alexander.
Everybody, welcome to the Galactic Roundtable. Let's launch right into hard news tonight.
Greetings.
Greetings.
Beth, do you want to go first?
No.
Okay. Rama?
Oh my, okay. Well, what I've been hearing out there, everyone, is that the don't ask, don't tell, it failed yesterday, yet there is going to be another let's say, round of this, and it's not over. Like everyone has been saying, this will totally come out in the right way. And Harry Reid will be giving that ring back to that soldier. And that's what I was told. It's about the law of one at this time. And the stories go to the sky.
Rum.
Yes.
It can be made an executive proclamation to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So what are we waiting for?
I will just say we are waiting for the next moment, which is called arrest. And any moment, I mean immediately,
in other words, just arrest and don't mess with me.
That's right. And it is already coming down as we are talking about this. And it has to do with the total transformation of this planet that we've been speaking about forever. And also, at the same time, there are several scenarios going on that have nothing to do with reality and have everything to do with reality. And that has to do with the higher levels going on in the understanding of the fact that what is happening is people are taking their power back like never before. And love is the frequency that's changing the planet. And it is the ultimate goal. It is already occurring. How this is affecting the news in present time has to do with the fact that the 13 families are out of money, out of power, and they're not out of time, yet they think they're out of time. Mother gives everyone up until the last second to heal. And that is what is occurring right now. And to take it to the highest levels, this moment right now, this full moon equinox with what is happening is the total transformation of this planet back to Sat Yuga rather than Kali Yuga. We're already in Sat Yuga, yet we are watching the last dredging of the lake, and I can't put it any plainer than that. What is going on is the Vatican Bank has been called on the carpet. Massive fraud, money laundering. This also involves the New Madrid Bank. And no one's saying that, yet I can say that it is being said that with the fall of the Vatican Bank comes the fall of the New Madrid Bank. In this country, there was a story that broke today in Huffington Post, massive foreclosure fraud going on all over this country.
That was countrywide, Lehman Brothers, with Bernie Madoff.
Bernie Madoff, Fannie and Freddie. Yeah.
Same bank that got the bailout for the ones who are doing it.
Say it nice and loud,
come over here.
The same bank that got the bailout money
are
the ones who are doing the
foreclosure. And the fraud is on them.
And we also, we have also heard that Mr. Rahm Emanuel and Larry Summers are leaving the White House. And
you said it could extend itself out to the 1st of October. I hope it's sooner than that because
we
all might have other things happening then.
And this has to do with the financial, economic high treason that goes to the sky with what is occurring right now.
Well, I want to say that this is no surprise. This has been in the master plan for since 2008, since November 4th of 2008. We knew that Emmanuel and Larry Summers would be leaving and that it was all in the plan. And Jonathan Alter's book, The Promise, you know, lays it out in lavender and explains to everybody how Barack Obama has been working with this corrupt cabinet and staff, and that he did it because it was the fastest way to the end. And it's not, this is no shocking surprise that they're leaving now. It was always planned. They brought in Elizabeth Warren to execute Nasara Law. It will be enacted as soon as we can handle it. And now the financial dudes of the staff are leaving. No big surprise.
Except that now we need to see them arrested, not just leave and be put loose in the country.
Correct. And I would just say that what is being said on the highest levels, and the text message I got from the king today talked about how the Vatican Bank, like yesterday, this goes to the sky with the finances. And what's not being said is that the New Madrid Bank is tied in with this, because Spain, the king of Spain is the king of Jerusalem. And all of this has to do with those stories going on. And at the same time, what we are seeing is more and more intensity with the issues at hand across the planet. And I heard a story today about Japan, where they took into custody a Chinese captain of a trawler, and they were saying that he was spying. And at the same time, China's giving a stern warning to Japan and to the U.S., do not mess with the South China Sea. All of these things have to do with the diversions going on with the ships coming in at such a rapid rate that full disclosure, first contact, Nasara, any number of scenarios could happen right now, simultaneously. It all has to do with how the balls get juggled, and Saint Germain just says, okay, we're going to talk about this ball. And that is what is being said at the highest levels.
They're going to talk about what?
Full disclosure, first contact Nasara. And
they need to arrest him first.
They need to arrest them immediately. And I keep asking, when is Nasara going to be announced? And I am hearing immediately, if not sooner. So that is the latest words. And take that to the bank. I am also hearing that there are, come October 1st, we may hear about the new currency that is in the banks.
Why do you say October 1st? No dates, no nukes, no flukes.
I am just saying that that's the end of the, that's the beginning of the new fiscal year, and there are hints that something is going to be announced on October 1st.
Oh, really?
Maybe it would be announced before October 1st, and then there would be a bank closing, and then maybe it would reopen on October 1st.
That could very well be. No one is telling.
Who's giving hints about October 1st?
Here and Now, a lady called Robin
and
Young.
Tell people what that is.
That's a show on NPR called
Here. Is that the BBS News show?
No, it's called Here and Now on NPR with Robin Young. And she was hinting today at something going on with the banks, yet she would not say what it was.
I noticed there's a lot of people coming out in the news, you know, mentioning dates. And, you know, this guy wrote a book and he was ex-NORAD, and he's saying he thinks the world will be covered in ships on October 13th, and Eshar always says no dates, no nukes, no flukes, and I really like to stick with that.
I concur.
In other words, you were giving a date.
I think these people are trying to get notoriety saying dates, because they know that everyone's going to go, oh, I don't want to go there.
Is Robin a white knight?
Yes, she is.
So then she's not doing that.
She is doing something that she knows, getting the word out, however the word needs to get out. yet no dates, no nukes, no flukes.
Except that she gave a date.
Well, she did. So I...
It's not really a date. It's the beginning of the new fiscal year. That's what people need to understand. It's a big difference from being a date.
The way you said it was that she was saying that on October 1st she might be getting an announcement, and she was making a hint that there might be an announcement on October 1st.
She didn't say what it was about.
She said
it just makes too much confusion, and it plays on people's heartstrings, and it gets them too upset. So the wording has to be really careful. It's 9 days from now. A lot can happen in 9 days.
That's
yes, let's
correct.
Leave it open for what that lot might be.
Yes, hold the same.
Never mind. I wanted to share with everyone that the president was at the UN today, and he made a humdinger of a speech, and I'd really like to share it.
Go ahead.
Je vais maintenant donner la parole à son Excellence, Monsieur Barack Obama, Président des États-Unis d'Amérique.
Good afternoon, Mr. Secretary General, fellow delegates, ladies and gentlemen. In the Charter of this United Nations, our countries pledge to work for the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all peoples. In the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we recognize the inherent dignity and rights of every individual, including the right to a decent standard of living. And a decade ago, at the dawn of a new millennium, we set concrete goals to free our fellow men, women, and children from the injustice of extreme poverty. These are the standards that we set. And today we must ask, are we living up to our mutual responsibilities? I suspect that some in wealthier countries may ask, with our economy struggling, so many people out of work, and so many families barely getting by, why a summit on development? And the answer is simple. In our global economy, progress in even the poorest countries can advance the prosperity and security of people far beyond their borders, including my fellow Americans. When a child dies from a preventable disease, it shocks all of our consciences. When a girl is deprived of an education, or her mother is denied equal rights, it undermines the prosperity of their nation. When a young entrepreneur can't start a new business, it stymies the creation of new jobs and markets in that entrepreneur's country, but also in our own. When millions of fathers cannot provide for their families, it feeds the despair that can fuel instability and violent extremism. When a disease goes unchecked, it can endanger the health of millions around the world. So let's put to rest the old myth that development is mere charity that does not serve our interests. And let's reject the cynicism that says certain countries are condemned to perpetual poverty. For the past half century has witnessed more gains in human development than at any time in history. A disease that had ravaged the generations, smallpox, was eradicated. Healthcare has reached the far corners of the world, saving the lives of millions. From Latin America to Africa to Asia, developing nations have transformed into leaders in the global economy. Nor can anyone deny the progress that has been made toward achieving certain Millennium Development Goals. The doors of education have been opened, to tens of millions of children, boys and girls. New cases of HIV/AIDS and malaria and tuberculosis are down. Access to clean drinking water is up. Around the world, hundreds of millions of people have been lifted from extreme poverty. That is all for the good. And it's a testimony to the extraordinary work that's been done both within countries and by the international community. Yet we must also face the fact that progress towards other goals that were set has not come nearly fast enough. Not for the hundreds of thousands of women who lose their lives every year simply giving birth. Not for the millions of children who die from the agony of malnutrition. Not for the nearly 1 billion people who endure the misery of chronic hunger. This is the reality we must face. That if the international community just keeps doing the same things the same way, we may make some modest progress here and there, but we will miss many development goals. That is the truth. With 10 years down and just 5 years before our development targets come due, we must do better. Now I know that helping communities and countries realize a better future is not easy. I've seen it in my own life. I saw it in my mother as she worked to lift up the rural poor from Indonesia to Pakistan. I saw it on the streets of Chicago where I worked as a community organizer trying to build up underdeveloped neighborhoods in this country. It is hard work. But I know progress is possible. As president, I have made it clear that the United States will do our part. My national security strategy recognizes development not only as a moral imperative, but a strategic and economic imperative. Secretary of State Clinton is leading a review to strengthen and better coordinate our diplomacy and our development efforts. We've re-engaged with multilateral development institutions, and we are rebuilding the United States Agency for International Development as the world's premier development agency. In short, we're making sure that the United States will be a global leader in international development in the 21st century. We also recognize, though, that the old ways will not suffice. That's why in Ghana last year I called for a new approach to development that unleashes transformational change and allows more people to take control of their own destiny. After all, no country wants to be dependent on another. No proud leader in this room wants to ask for aid. No family wants to be beholden to the assistance of others. To pursue this vision, my administration conducted a comprehensive review of America's development programs. We listened to leaders in government, NGOs, and civil society, the private sector and philanthropy, Congress, and our many international partners. And today I'm announcing our new U.S. global development policy, the first of its kind by an American administration. It's rooted in America's enduring commitment to the dignity and potential of every human being. And it outlines our new approach and the new thinking that will guide our overall development efforts, including the plan that I promised last year and that my administration has delivered to pursue the Millennium Development Goals. Put simply, the United States is changing the way we do business. First, we're changing how we define development. For too long, we've measured our efforts by the dollars we spent and the food and medicines that we delivered. But aid alone is not development. Development is helping nations to actually develop, moving from poverty to prosperity. And we need more than just aid to unleash that change. We need to harness all the tools at our disposal, from our diplomacy to our trade policies to our investment policies. Second, we are changing how we view the ultimate goal of development. Our focus on assistance has saved lives in the short term, but it hasn't always improved those societies over the long term. Consider the millions of people who have relied on food assistance for decades. That's not development. That's dependence. And it's a cycle we need to break. Instead of just managing poverty, we have to offer nations and peoples a path out of poverty. Now let me be clear. The United States of America has been and will remain the global leader in providing assistance. We will not abandon those who depend on us for life-saving help, whether it's food or medicine. We will keep our promises and honor our commitments. In fact, my administration has increased assistance to the least developed countries. We're working with partners to finally eradicate polio. We're building on the good efforts of my predecessor to continue to increase funds to fight HIV/AIDS, increasing those funds to record levels. And that includes strengthening our commitment to the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and malaria. And we will lead in times of crisis, as we've done since the earthquake in Haiti and the floods in Pakistan. But the purpose of development, what's needed most right now, is creating the conditions where assistance is no longer needed. So we will seek partners who want to build their own capacity to provide for their people. We will seek development that is sustainable. Building in part on the lessons of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which has helped countries like El Salvador build rural roads and raise the incomes of its people, we will invest in the capacity of countries that are proving their commitment to development. Remembering the lessons of the Green Revolution, we're expanding scientific collaboration with other countries and investing in game-changing science and technology to help spark historic leaps in development. For example, instead of just treating HIV/AIDS, we've invested in pioneering research to finally develop a way to help millions of women actually prevent themselves from being infected in the first place. Instead of simply handing out food, our food security initiative is helping countries like Guatemala and Rwanda and Bangladesh develop their agriculture and improve crop yields and help farmers get their products to market. Instead of simply delivering medicine, our global health initiative is also helping countries like Mali and Nepal build stronger health systems and better deliver care. And with financial and technical assistance, we'll help developing countries embrace the clean energy technologies they need to adapt to climate change and pursue low-carbon growth. In other words, we're making it clear that we will partner with countries that are willing to take the lead. Because the days when European capitals must come to an end. This brings me to a third pillar of our new approach. To unleash transformational change, we're putting a new emphasis on the most powerful force the world has ever known for eradicating poverty and creating opportunity. It's the force that turned South Korea from a recipient of aid to a donor of aid. It's the force that has raised living standards from Brazil to India. And it's the force that has allowed emerging African countries like Ethiopia and Malawi and Mozambique to defy the odds and make real progress towards achieving the Millennium Development Goals, even as some of their neighbors, like Cote d'Ivoire, have lagged. The force I'm speaking about is broad-based economic growth. Now, every nation will pursue its own path to prosperity. But decades of experience tell us there are certain ingredients upon which sustainable growth and lasting development depends. We know that countries are more likely to prosper when they encourage entrepreneurship, when they invest in their infrastructure, when they expand trade and welcome. So we will partner with countries like Sierra Leone to create business environments that are attractive to investment, that don't scare it away. We'll work to break down barriers to regional trade and urge nations to open their markets to developing countries. We will keep pushing for a Doha round that is ambitious and balanced, one that works not just for major emerging economies, but for all economies. We also know that countries are more likely to prosper when governments are accountable to their people. So we are leading a global effort to combat corruption, which in many places is the single greatest barrier to prosperity, and which is a profound violation of human rights. That's why we now require oil, gas, and mining companies that raise capital in the United States to disclose all payments to governments. And it's why I urge the G20 to put corruption on its agenda and make it harder for corrupt officials to steal from their own people and stifle their nation's development. The United States will focus our development efforts on countries like Tanzania that promote good governance and democracy, the rule of law, and equal administration of justice, transparent institutions with strong civil societies and respect for human rights, because over the long run, democracy and economic growth go hand in hand. We will reach out to countries making transitions from authoritarianism to democracy and from war to peace. The people of Liberia, for example, show that even after years of war, great progress can be achieved. And as others show the courage to put war behind them, including, we hope, in Sudan, the United States will stand with those who seek to build and sustain peace. We also know that countries are more likely to prosper when they tap the talents of all their people. And that's why we're investing in the health, education, and rights of women, and working to empower the next generation of women entrepreneurs and leaders. Because when mothers and daughters have access to opportunity, that's when economies grow, that's when governance improves. And it's why we're partnering with young people, who in many developing countries are more than half the population. We're expanding educational exchanges, like the one that brought my father here to America from Kenya. And we're helping young entrepreneurs succeed in a global economy. And as the final pillar of our new approach, we will insist on more responsibility from ourselves and from others. We insist on mutual accountability. For our part, we'll work with Congress to better match our investments with the priorities of our partner countries. Guided by the evidence, we will invest in programs that work. We'll end those that don't. We need to be big-hearted, but also hard-headed in our approach to development. To my fellow donor nations, let's honor our respective commitments. Let's resolve. Let's resolve to put an end to hollow promises that are not kept. Let's commit to the same transparency that we expect from others. Let's move beyond the old narrow debate over how much money we're spending, and instead let's focus on results, whether we're actually making improvements in people's lives. Now, to developing countries, this must be your moment of responsibility as well. We want you to prosper and succeed. It is not only in your interest, it is in our interest. We want to help you realize your aspirations as a nation and the individuals in each of your countries. But there's no substitute for your leadership. Only you and your people can make the tough choices that will unleash the dynamism of your country. Only you can make the sustainable investments that improve the health and well-being of your people. Only you can deliver your nations to a more prosperous and just future. We can be partners, but ultimately, you have to take the lead. Finally, let me say this. No one nation can do everything everywhere and still do it well. To meet our goals, we must be more selective and focus our efforts where we have the best partners and where we can have the greatest impact. And just as this work cannot be done by any one government, it can't be the work of governments alone. In fact, foundations and private sector and NGOs are making historic commitments that have redefined what's possible. And this gives us the opportunity to forge a new division of labor for development in the 21st century. It's a division of labor where, instead of so much duplication and inefficiency, governments and multilaterals and NGOs are all working together. We each do the piece that we do best, as we're doing, for example, in support of Ghana's food security plan, which will help more farmers get more goods to market and earn more money to support their families. So that's the progress that's possible. Together we can collaborate in ways unimaginable just a few years ago. Together we can realize the future that none of us can achieve alone. Together we can deliver historic leaps in development. We can do this, but only if we move forward with a seriousness and sense of common purpose that this moment demands. Development that offers a path out of poverty for that child who deserves better. Development that builds the capacity of countries to deliver the healthcare and education that their people need. Development that unleashes broader prosperity and builds the next generation of entrepreneurs and emerging economies. Development rooted in shared responsibility, mutual accountability, and most of all, concrete results that pull communities and countries from poverty to prosperity. These are the elements of America's new approach. This is the work that we can do together. And this can be our plan, not simply for meeting our Millennium Development Goals, but for exceeding them and then sustaining them for generations to come. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you.
So what'd you think of that?
That was awesome.
I think he's going to get even more strong every time he gets up there to talk now.
It is about educating our children and restoring this country back to what we had when JFK was putting his hand out and saying to Khrushchev, let's do something different. Let's invite our galactic brothers and sisters down to the table. This is what's being said.
Right. That's right. This is a prelude to the Day of Emergence, this speech. Taking care of each other. We can do it together. He didn't say we can do it with love, but it was implied.
Yes. And this is the thing that Richard Hoagland talks about so eloquently with this story. Also, Nick Begich, who is the brother of Mark Begich, the senator from Alaska, who took Ted Stevens' place, thank God. And I'm just saying that Nick Begich has so many stories that go to the sky with Richard Hoagland about these folks who have tried to usurp this planet, and now it's over.
It is over.
It is really over.
It really is over.
And what we are witnessing are the very final dredging, like, of the lake, I said, and it is ugly what's coming up with the mud. You don't want to know.
Well, we do. We need to witness it now, and everybody needs to just think with their hearts.
Well, there's a couple of stories that on the news that I put on the round table, and we shared them last night on Astro on the Road, but, you know, there's other ones here tonight, so I want to say them again.
Yes. Go ahead, Beth.
Well, there's this, I didn't mention this one last night. It's about Tony Blair, and there's a picture of him on the round table, and it says, if I start an illegal war, does it make me a criminal? And the answer is no ifs, no buts. To initiate a war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime. It goes on to a report calling 9/11 a false flag to take us into war, and it explains how that happened, and then there's some graphic and sad pictures, so if you're extremely sensitive, you shouldn't look at it, because it shows how they're using nuclear arms and shooting them through people's windows of their house, and then the belly of the person and the arms is burned away from the nuclear weapon, but the shoulders and head and legs are fine because they were shot through a window and the house blocked the rest of the body. And this is just one family, one incident. This has been going on for 9 years in Afghanistan.
Yes. And
like Tara says, we need to face up to it. We need to look at it. We need to praise, thank, love, and respect it so we can heal it with love.
And all the feelings it brings up. As we do that, we do it for the whole planet. Exactly as, you know, Carolyn was teaching us to eat for the whole planet, to drink for the whole planet. Now we do this for the whole planet.
Thank you, everybody, for being here with me witnessing this. You're making a big difference.
It's tough watching it. And I would just say that what my understanding about it, and I'll repeat this if I haven't said it before, the poppy lady lost a lot of her family in Afghanistan, and this had to do when the Russians invaded Afghanistan in 1979-78, and then they left, and the Mujahideen and the other issues that happened with the warlords and the deals that were made with tribal leaders, and I will just say that, you know,
that was all under the influence of the CIA.
Yeah, and this goes to the sky,
and the only reason that they did that battle with Russia was to use Afghanistan as an experiment to see all the new weapons and play with them and see which one they liked the best that they would make more of.
They've killed a lot of people.
That's exactly what they did. That's the same thing they did starting in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That was just an experiment.
And the poppy lady said that, you know, in the years that I've known her, she has 3 kids, and her husband, he's gone. So are her mother and her father, and she has 1 brother and 1 sister left. And that is all from her family from Afghanistan. And
how many in her family before that?
Her mother and her father and her husband are gone. They were killed.
Jesus.
Yeah. And she has a brother and a sister. And
I remember this other young lady that lost like 19 members of her family. That's, one hit.
Yeah. And all of this has to do with the poppies. That is the issue at hand. And I can also...
Well, that has to do with... That's where they make their most money, to keep the other things they want to do going,
and,
like war.
And this also... What I have heard today is that now the CIA are training in Pakistan, and they have a secret Pakistani branch of the CIA, along with a secret branch in Afghanistan. And also, I was, in fact, I heard an interview with Dar Jamal today. I forgot where I heard it. It might have been on the News Hour on BBC, where he was talking with an Afghan person who, in a sense, has defected from the secret group of the CIA, who are being trained in the Americas, in the U.S. of A., to go back to Afghanistan and be, infiltrate, quote-unquote, the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda, and, you know, do things to create instability amongst their own ranks. And Dar Jamal said that many of these folks just will not violate the code of ethics within their people. They are rebelling, and they are basically just saying, keep your money, CIA, keep your hands out of my family. And I mean, it was very good to hear Dar Jamal talking about this. Dar Jamal is a man who has been in and out of Afghanistan and Iraq since we did 9/11, and he's one of our real reporters, like Jeremy Scahill, that's not embedded with a news agency or the FCC, and he tells the truth. He is unembedded. And he comes on Free Speech and World Link TV.
And Laura Flanders.
And Grit TV with Laura Flanders. He,
and Tom Hartman.
Yeah. Randy Rhodes.
We haven't had
Mike
a chance
Malloy.
To listen to Tom Hartman for quite a while we've been here on the road.
Yeah.
But, everybody who has the access to Free Speech television, Tom Hartman's very amazing on Free Speech, and he's also on the radio. It's 3 hours a day. And be really grateful as people would call in and share anything they learn when they listen to him, as we're unable to do that very regularly while we're traveling. And the thing I like about him so much is that he is so well-versed in all the historical references of what happened in this country, especially, and especially with knowledge of the Founding Father, in particular of Thomas Jefferson. And he has a great deal to say about James Madison's work, too. I'm just very, very happy to welcome people coming in and sharing anything that might come about on a daily basis regarding the unfoldment of our freedom and our blessings and justice right now. And
I would also,
again, as Rahm Emanuel is stating when he's deciding maybe he'll step down on the 1st of October, that, well, Rama seemed to say that he had something to do with a banking, what, a fund or something?
He had been, quote-unquote, called back to Chicago to work for a financial brokerage house. Whatever that means.
Why would he leave a White House job to do that? So dumb.
Because Rami.
So dumb.
Money. I am broke.
Let's just say the man needs to chill. He is a member of the Mossad. Like
he's not a member of the Mossad. He's the head of the Mossad in the United States. That's a very telling, very criminal thing to have to know about a person like that. It is a crime to have another secret intelligence agency in full force in another country. That is not anything less than high treason.
And supposedly Netanyahu and Abbas are close to an agreement in Palestine.
They agree to orange outfits and shekels. That's what they're agreeing to.
That's right.
Okay.
That's biding time. That's delaying. That's giving people
blah,
false. What?
Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Well, I would just say
it's an opportunity for this time to call their bluff.
Yeah.
And call it for the last time.
Right.
And I would say that ultimately, Lady Mastronata has the final say-so in the situation of the Middle East. And she is the one who is in charge with that situation with her husband.
She's not going to be the one on the screen doing the stuff at the beginning, though.
No.
She's going to stay in the
All I'm saying is that when I hear that they say that Abbas and Netanyahu are coming together, I'm thinking, oh, really? Is that coming from Hillary Clinton?
Absolutely.
It's just a lie.
It's a blatant lie. Netanyahu has no capacity to do anything in the realm of positive action. He doesn't have the ability. He sold his soul long time ago.
Hey, Earl is here.
Hi, Earl. Greetings.
Can you guys okay?
No, not really.
Well, I should be okay.
Okay, that sounds a little better. Go ahead, Earl.
Okay, well, first thing I want to start with is blah, 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 blah.
Thanks, Earl.
Anytime, Beth. are we going to start seeing a trend now where church leaders, like, now it seems to be with this one bishop in this one church that three charges of misconduct are being brought against them. Are we starting to see this whole thing play out now? It's starting to trickle down, not just in the Catholic Church, but in the in all the other types of churches.
Yeah, I saw this news story, Earl, and you know, a lot of these ones in these big mega churches are programmed, and they're doing this for, you know, for their handlers. And yes, all of this is coming out now, all at once.
Because it just seems like so. It sort of gives me a feeling like, okay. You know, I think.
You know,
now it comes out.
John Lennon wrote a song, and he said in the song that, just tell me the truth. And he said that, you know, people stay doped up with drugs and religion and TV. And, you know, that's Afghanistan and the poppies and the war. And religion is, you know, supposed to keep the slaves quiet so they'll follow instructions. And, you know, the TV is programming all of us. So as long as we keep a low consciousness, they can do whatever they want. And that's the crime that these mega churches are committing.
Yeah. Well, that's all I have pretty much for now.
It's good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you. I've been having a little bit of trouble hearing the call tonight. My internet connection seems to go in and out a bit at times.
I think that's the high energies, Earl.
Hmm.
The ships are all lining up in the sky.
Well, like ducks in a row, huh?
Yes, ducks in a row.
Okay, well, I passed the rainbow talking stick, and, oh yeah, I turned 35 over the weekend on Friday, so.
Happy birthday, Earl. Tara, is Earl a real Libra or something else?
What's the...
September 17th.
Okay, you are a Virgo. Because
yeah,
Leo...
I know Leo, I'm a Virgo.
Wait. No, wait a minute. What... Yes, well, Leo ends on the 16th of September. So you are the first day of Libra, of Virgo, instead of what you thought. You know, you know, the 17th is usually toward the end of Virgo. It's not, it's at the beginning of the Virgo, so that means you've got a lot of Leo energy in you, because you're the first day of Virgo. So that's something new for you to think about. And being the first day of the purity of heart sign. That's what Virgo is. It's the sign of purity of heart. And if anything comes pure of heart, you do. Thank you, Earl.
Well, I should be the one thanking you.
Well, we are a reflection of ourselves, aren't we? I love you more, Earl.
Yes. Well, keep on talking.
Keep on talking, keep on walking, walking to the freedom land. Aho.
I had an interesting experience. I had an interesting experience I wanted to share with everybody tonight.
Go ahead.
So, you know, we've been talking a lot about sovereignty and recognizing that we are a sentient being and that when you're the secured party, you're the CEO of your corporation. And the name, the all caps name, is the one they presume who is me. And that's because they are operating from inside admiralty law. And so what happened to me tonight was I had purchased my house with alternate financing. And the person I purchased the house from got into a contract with me as an individual. I've been here for 3 years, and I have 60 emails from this person harassing me about different things, and none of it's true. So I followed the law as a sentient being, and I took 60 emails plus an affidavit down to the courthouse, and I put it into the public record. I wrote a cease and desist letter, and I said, if you're going to contact me again, do it in writing. And that's my legal right to do that. And they are saying that if we need a remedy, we should use the least force necessary to enforce our rights. And so it's proper to write a letter, and it's important to put it into the public record. So the way the law reads is that after 30 days with no written reply, then it becomes fact in law. So the person I wrote the cease and desist letter to, meaning don't email me and harass me, and here's your 60 emails and they're in the public record, unless that person goes point by point and answers every time they emailed me, and why they said what they said, and that it wasn't harassment, after 30 days it becomes fact in law, and they won't be able to dispute it in a court of law because they didn't write to me within 30 days. And so today during the day, there was a knock on my door, and I never saw the guy before, and I didn't know the vehicle. And I had a feeling that maybe it was someone who wanted me to serve papers to me, and so I didn't answer the door. And I've always paid my payments every month. I've never gone outside of our contract at all. I've done everything right. I just wrote him and said, don't email me and harass me like that. And so this guy came back repeatedly throughout the day, and less than 20 minutes before the program tonight, he was pounding on my door, and then he walked up to the window and pounded on the window where he could see where I was sitting. And I told him, I'm calling the police, and he said, good. And so I called the police, and the sheriff came. The police from my town came, and the sheriff came. So the first thing that happened was, the policeman came to the door, and he knows me. I'm in a really small area. And he took my name, and he took my date of birth, and he took the reason why I called. So did the guy on the phone when I called the sheriff's office. So I told the policeman again when he got here. And then the sheriff came behind him. And, you know, after I told the policeman who I was and why I called him, I said, I don't know this guy, and he's at my house, and he's pounding on my windows, and I want him to leave, and he's not leaving. So he got my information and he left and he went outside. So then the sheriff came and I went outside and took pictures of them, and I was getting ready to videotape it. So the sheriff came over to me and he said he wanted to know my name. And I said, wait, I'm getting my videotape ready and my video recorder ready. And he reacted instantly and he said, you're not going to videotape me. And then I knew where he was coming from. And I was just smiling under my breath. I didn't say anything. And so he was trying to lure me out onto the grass to talk to him. And I said, you can talk to me, but you have to come inside because I'm not coming out there, you know, with that guy and the policeman. And I went inside the house and left the door open. So the sheriff reluctantly followed me in. And he started asking me questions, and I said, that guy is harassing me. And he said, well, I'm not harassing you. And I put my hands on my hips, and I very calmly, in a low voice, said, make sure that you don't. And his eyes popped out of his head, and he said, what did you say to me? And I didn't flinch. Because I wanted him to know that he wasn't going to take over the conversation and he wasn't going to strong arm me. And I said that the authorities and the judges and the attorneys in this county have a track record of not being kind to women. And I didn't say I'm mad at telling I'm not going to take it anymore, but it was implied. So he made me repeat everything, my name, my date of birth, and why he was there. I showed him a copy of the cease and desist order and the 60 emails that just happened to be sitting on the dining room table. And I told him I knew why that guy was there and I didn't want him here harassing me or anyone in my family. And so then he made me repeat everything again. This is getting to be 10 minutes before the radio program. And so I got impatient and I don't know why he was making me repeat everything again, and I asked him to leave and to have that other guy leave. And then he said to me, this guy is here from an attorney's office, and he has some papers for you. Will you take them? I had just got done telling him that he needs to serve me through the mail, that the cease and desist order says he can only reach me in writing, you know, and that he needs to serve papers through the mail, and he is not allowed to come to my house and harass me. And I know the law, I told the policeman. I told the sheriff, I know the law. And he kept, you know, asking me questions and going over things. And then he said to me, you know, this guy's from an attorney's office, and he has some papers for you. Will you take them now? And I said, I haven't taken them all day when he came to my house 5 times. Why are you inviting me to take these papers now? I said, now you're harassing me. And he didn't say anything. He wrapped it up and he left. And when the guy was pounding at my window and I told him I'm calling the police, he said, go ahead. And he parked right in front of my front door to, you know, make it look like he's trying to intimidate me. And 2 police cars came. And most women would have been shaking and crying and upset. And I was telling the policeman, make sure you don't harass me. And these guys are doing everything in their power to take our power away. The reason this one wants to take this house away from me is to flip the property and make more money. And the reason he went into a contract with me is because he thought I would fail in the contract. I am the 4th person who's been in here, and he's trying to flip me to make more money. And the police are assuming I don't know the law. The sheriff's assuming I don't know the law. And the attorney's dude is assuming I don't know the law. So as we file our UCC-1 forms, it puts a lien on our property. And what that lien means is that the lien is placed in my name, the sentient being. So if anyone has a lawsuit with the property, it can't be paid out to anyone else except for me, because the lien is owed to me. And that protects the property. And there's also other things you can do. And so there's two things I want to say about this. Any chief of police, any state police, any sheriff, any marshal, anyone who thinks they're in authority, any attorney, and any judge who has been for years railroading women and children against the law, and anybody who's been jailing people against the law is going to be arrested now. Your time is over. And the other thing I want to say is, there's two other things I want to say. Everybody out there who's dealing with the IRS or losing your house or you can't pay your bills, I want to tell you, I'm standing right next to you. I'm here with you. I hear you. And it's all going to be fine. We're going to do this together, and we're going to do it with love. And there's nothing that can be taken away from you because you're a sentient being. And there's nobody that can hurt you because you are an immortal. And the third thing I want to say is, if you haven't done your research and you haven't educated yourself and you have not yet filed your UCC-1, if that hasn't inspired you as being important, I ask you to revisit it. And that's what I wanted to share.
Beth.
Mm-hmm.
I got this message. It came out of flying out of nowhere while you were talking. And I thought, this is about the return of the Buddha within and without. And what does that mean? I said, well, which Buddha do I get to have? And I said, I want this Buddha. Did you ever hear of the Buddha? His name is Fun Wei.
Right.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
I am not kidding. It is the Fun Wei, and that is the only way. Are we having fun yet? I'll tell you what, Beth, listening to you describe in detail the analysis of the situation that is irrefutable and put these people's faces in positions they weren't really willing to go and had no choice because you put it like it is. And it showed up on their faces. Now, didn't it, Beth?
That part was fun, I have to admit it, because these guys think they're so special.
And
just a short little thing, and they're these big burly guys, and they try to lord over women, and I'm tired of that. And I said it with a calm voice, and my face didn't turn red, and I wasn't upset, and I wasn't shaking. And yeah, both of the police told me not to boss them around. And I was laughing inside.
And we have a caller, Beth.
Hi, Sarah.
How is everybody?
Greetings.
We're tired.
We're fine, and we can do better. Yes, we can.
We can barely hear you.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I'm listening on my cell phone, but I'm calling because of what Beth was just talking about. I, for the last couple of weeks, have been intensively studying the whole concept of being secured party and sovereign, and I would highly recommend anybody who wants to learn the perspective to check out Brandon Adams on Creditors in Commerce. He spells it out in the spiritual sense, the whole perspective of where you're coming from as a sentient being, sovereign. You are with the rights that God gave you that nobody can take away. And when you understand that, you own the world, and nobody can touch you, ever. But the way he presents
Sarah,
it, Yeah.
Let me correct that. I want to say that you own your reality.
Well, okay, well, I mean that figuratively. Yes, you own your world. Nobody can mess with your world.
Right, that's right.
Let's see, what else was I going to say? I had two or three things I was going to say. I have not figured out just yet how to go about doing all of the paperwork and filing certain things for certain reasons. I have filed the UCC form, and I'm glad to know that does in fact put a lien on my house, because that means I don't have to worry about my house, I don't think. But even if I did, it wouldn't be for very long at this point. But it is important to understand. Oh, I know what I was going to say was the concept that the Illuminati use when they are going to do something that they have to show in public, hide it in plain sight, so to speak, and tell publicly what they're going to do. Well, they do that with this whole system that we live in every single year, probably multiple times a year. I know it is since cable TV. Every time they show the Wizard of Oz on TV, they're telling us what they're doing to us. And it's just like one of those pictures where there's hidden pictures in it and you have to look all over for it and find it. But once you see it, it stands out like a sore thumb. But the Wizard of Oz is very plainly tells exactly the real world versus the fiction world that they place us in. And it's all the man behind the curtain that's doing it. And it's interesting. If somebody could find that on the internet somewhere, I've heard it twice before, but the parallel is just amazing. But we really are living in an illusion that's been created for us, and it's legal not to live in it, but they just never bothered to tell us that. So it's important for people to understand just exactly how that illusion is, in fact, not real. It is fiction. And it's all fear. It's fear making you think this is your reality, and that's how they control us. The other thing was that he states very clearly that when you get into an interchange with somebody in the fiction world, if you never make a statement and you only ask a question, you never, ever, ever give them the power to mess with you. And if you look at the word asking as in a question, you take it as you're speaking as king, ASKING. And if you can remember that when you get into where you're talking to somebody, as long as you don't ever make a statement, because once you make a statement, then you take a stance. And if they can never make you make a stance, then they don't have anything. So that's the key. And if you could just keep asking questions, they'll eventually figure you know what you're talking about, and they'll give up. So, but that's what you do if you ever have to go to court. And you don't ever go across that little fence in a courtroom, because you're in their jurisdiction then. If you're behind the bar, which is what that little fence is, you're not in their jurisdiction, and they don't have jurisdiction over you. So if they come up here to the front and you say, no, I'm fine right here, thank you. But everything's on a different plane, even in a courtroom. The witness box, anything in a box does not exist. It's fiction. So, and everything in a courtroom is in a box. There's a witness box and there's the jury's box, and so those are not real. And they're all on different planes. They're all different levels.
Let me share this. The sheriff said to me, you know, this guy's from an attorney's office and he has some papers for you, so would you take them now? And I asked him and I said, if I haven't taken them five times today and I called you because he won't leave and he's pounding on the windows. Why are you inviting me now to take them?
Very good.
And then he didn't reply, and I said to him, cease and desist means cease and desist, and then he left.
Right.
But the thing is that this guy who works for, you know, I mean, this is a small place. And the attorney is small time, small town. And so yeah. This guy's been working this county probably for 20 years. And when I told him I was calling the police, he said, you go ahead. And he knew that the police would ask me to take the papers. And I bet you 99.9% of people take the papers after the police have been called. Because they get so beaten down by the answering the questions of the police. Finally, I got impatient, and he kept saying, what else is going on here? And I said, I have to go to work. And you need to leave because I can't work with you talking to me.
Well, most of the lawyers are not schooled or trained in commercial law. They are only trained to do what they're told to do, which is to pass the bar, which is the fictional law. They don't know the truth. And most policemen don't. Some are pretty savvy, but most of them are not. The judges, on the other hand, are, and they know. And they are also a bank because they sit on the bench. And in Latin, the word bench means bank. And also,
all I know that what I was doing was sticking up for women and children in the vibration of the changes that we're going through, standing there telling the authorities, women and children are not going to take this harassment anymore. We know the law, and we know we're sentient beings, and there's nothing you can do. So get out of the house and get off the land.
But it's key to speak the proper language of the commercial law, because they have no recourse. If you slip up and say it the wrong way, then they've got you, because it puts you in a different reality. And if you know the language, it's best to stick with the language of commercial law.
I have a friend who says to me that calmer heads prevail.
What?
Calmer heads prevail.
I don't know what that means.
Calmer heads prevail. It means when you follow the first law of love, it's be calm.
Yes, it's true.
That's not me. I'm shouting at the cop, get out of here, get out of here. I got to get on the radio.
I know it, but what's really cool about when you hear Brandon Adams describe the two different worlds, he really explains it in such a way that it truly is spiritual.
Yeah.
And that the whole basis of it is that he's not so much a Christian. He's well read in all the religions. But he used the example that the double entry bookkeeping system is what it's based on. In our fiction world, they've only taught us half of it. They didn't teach us the other half of the double entry. And any debt that we have, when they took away gold-backed currency or metal-backed currency, they took away our right to pay our debts with real money. And so what they gave us instead was no money, but they can't do that. It's fraud unless they give us a remedy. So the remedy is that we don't have to pay anything in terms of money because they took that away from us. So when you pay with a Federal Reserve note, that's a promissory note. But they've told us that's cash. and there's no debt when you pay with that. But what they didn't tell you is that whatever you pay with a promissory note or an FRN, a Federal Reserve note, creates a debt. And the other half of the double entry bookkeeping system is that you have a prepaid account in the U.S. Treasury that's sitting there. There is no such thing as money until you create it. When you sign your name on a piece of paper, you create money. So,
I'd like to share something about this, Sarah.
Okay.
When we're talking about Nisara law, we're saying that a law had to be written in order to pay the black farmers' cases. And one of those cases is called the Pigford case. And what happened was so many years went by that the Supreme Court justices refused to have this settlement paid, that a new law was written to take care of it. And when the Nisara law is enacted, all of the things you're talking about will go away. They're going to arrest. Sarah, wait. They're going to arrest these sheriffs, the police, the attorneys, the judges, and everyone who hasn't been following the law. And what happens is that that we are going to return this corporation back into the American Republic. And it's going to be headed up by the president, Barack Obama. And there's a reason why he gave up his British accredited registry. There's a reason why Michelle gave up hers, Michelle Obama, and there's a reason why Bill Clinton gave up his, because we are becoming the American Republic. And President Obama mentioned this in his speech on September 10th. He was in a press conference in the White House, and the person asked him a question, and this was it. "Thank you, Mr. President. I want to ask a couple of questions on the economy. Would you discuss your efforts at reviewing history as it relates to the poverty agenda, meaning LBJ and Dr. King? And also, since Senate Republicans are holding up the issue of Cobell and Pigford too, can you make any assurances before you leave office that you will make sure that these awards are funded?" This reporter was asking the president in front of everybody, "Are you going to bring the enactment of Nisara law?" And the president said, on September 10th, 2010, "Let me take the second question first. For those who aren't familiar, Cobell and Pigford relate to settlements surrounding historic discrimination against minority farmers who weren't oftentimes provided the same benefits as everybody else under the USDA. It's a fair settlement. It's a just settlement. We think it's important for Congress to fund that settlement. We're going to continue to make it a priority." He's talking about Nisara law. And now we're seeing the crumbling of New Madrid Bank, and the Vatican's being brought up on money laundering charges, and he has appointed Elizabeth Warren to execute Nisara law. And now today we heard that Larry Summers is leaving the White House. I don't see how much closer we could be to arrest the man.
Okay, I guess all I'm trying to say is that what... Hello?
Hi.
I guess what I'm trying to say is the whole spiritual background behind what is coming forth before the announcement of Nisara is that we already have Nisara. It just hadn't been announced yet, in so many words. I'm simply trying to say
it needs to be announced and enacted. Tara, can you talk to us about that?
Do what?
Tara, are you there?
Yes, we were just getting to the unmuting section. Just wanted to give a clearer signal as possible.
Tara, tell me again what's going to happen with announcements in the SARA law, please.
Okay. Number one is arrest with full disclosure. We're already seeing their hand in hand. They're holding hands together. And we are the head guard, you might say. We are the guardians at the gate. Anyone that's listening within range of this call or post this call or connecting to all other beings who are doing the same thing in their perfection, where the attention is needed, wherever they are on this beautiful breast of this beautiful mother. And let me just tell you, we just had the experience. We're in our new home here, and there's this beautiful child, and her name is Leela. And Leela is 1 year, 9 months old, and she's a star child of the magenta ray. And we are on the completion, I believe, with her. And the completion of what? Of the divine Leela. Indeed. And that is exactly okay. I guess, Sarah, we lost you. We make a curve out of a hard ball, you might say. Is that the way you can see that this was, you know, we were thrown a curve and a half every step of the way. And I was just talking to Grand Goddess Lily with our sister and brother in this room right here, Lady Master Rainbird and Rama. And we were saying, you know, not one more white hair on Mr. President Obama's head should need to show up over this one. It's time for this hard ball to be turned into a curve, which is, you might say, in effect, a boomerang that is absolutely on target to retrieve its sender home. And E.T. go home, and may Mother Lioness, Goddess, Mother Sekhmet, season her justice with mercy. And Lady Master Nada, as yes and still and yet and still, head of this republic, and this galactic republic indeed. And that's why we're having a full disclosure of. And we were told with, you know, you might say reservations that it could go to a simulcast, and it's not a could go, it's a coulda, woulda, shoulda, and no go. It is a go that this happens simultaneously. So you've got a grin like a Cheshire cat on your face. Commander Rama, I pass the talking stick.
I would just say that I am only speaking from experience, from the understanding of what I've witnessed with serendipitous events where Sananda and Ashtar pull the rug out from under us and they just make the magic happen, and I have no say-so. I'm just reporting on what's going
How
on.
How loud do we have to say uncle?
I think it's being heard in this moment, and this is why it's moving into the inaugural level where non-ordinary reality is the reality. And yes, the stories are being turned around where these judges, these cops, these lawyers, all of the universal harmonics of the frequencies that had been out of disharmony are turned back to harmony right now, and it has to do with the frequencies shifted back to Sat Yuga, all the exposures of statutory law that have to do were keeping us as slaves and them our masters, it's over. And this matrix game is over. This is why these guys are being exposed to some of the largest stories right now on the planet, having to do with the Vatican Bank being audited, you could say, for financial fraud that goes to the level of the crown heads of Europe. And it is not pretty. All of this has to do with how, yes, judges are banks, and it's it is time for the man to show up with the lavender suit. He has the answers to this, and I would pass the talking stick to him in that sense.
Well, as far as judges being bankers, it reminds me of Michael Moore's movie, Capitalism, A Love Story, and those judges were throwing those teenagers into this mental health prison because they were getting kickbacks from the insurance company, and it was so sick.
We know someone who that happened to, and this child, let's just say, Archangel Michael's walking with this child, and nobody touches this child. Let's put it that way. And all of these issues are coming back to wholeness as the stories get told, and these folks are having to face their crimes against humanity, because it goes into, we are all one race, and it's called humanity.
Right. So,
Beth?
Yeah.
I was just tossing my consciousness to something that might depict what we've been talking about here, which is unity consciousness and the healing of separation, all separation.
Right.
And this is from what we started to look at the last time, universal harmonics. And we are in that modality right now in a sovereignty setting where I said this so many times because teachers said it too. It is impossible for individuals to be sovereign. It is a group activity. Sovereignty is a consciousness that is agreed. And that's why we have to understand what this is about in terms of how do we understand sovereignty unless we've experienced separation. And that's what the discussion starts. Can I read this little insert here?
Well, we have Alan on line one.
Oh, we do. Okay, Alan, we will say hi to you on line one, Commander.
Okay, we had a problem with the phone. Am I on?
You're
here.
Holy cow. Okay, I came right out of context, and I wasn't even listening to you guys call, but something told me to call. And this is a call of gratitude. We made it, my friends. It's here. It's now. And everybody's seen it from their own perspective, but it's just one of the most beautiful times of my life. And it took all of us with everything we had to throw it into the pot. You guys have all made a difference, and maybe so did I. So I wanted to thank you, all of you, okay, on this call. And thank you for your courage and your love and your light. Here it comes, baby. My love to you all. Aloha.
Aloha. Namaste. I thank you. Tara, what I want to do now is take a song break, and then when we come back from the song, I would like us all to meditate together for the equinox. We're coming up on that in 20 minutes.
Cool.
Rama, can you find a song of praise for us?
Okay, just a moment here.
Sounds like you are with a chorus of crickets tonight.
Yeah.
Yes, we have a chorus. Many.
I hear it, yeah.
Oh, okay. I was going to go back up to the top on the way, maybe.
Okay.
Okay, this is Deva Primal, the Gayatri Mantra meditation.
Thank you so much.
Savitra
Thank you, Beth. I think Swami Swarna did it again.
I think so too.
Okay.
Now I would like to share after you turned on your speakers. thank you. I'd like to share a brief teaching, and then I would like us to join in meditation together. In 19 minutes, let's see, 21 minutes, it will be the equinox. After we do the meditation, I'm going to close it with a song. We're going to do a meditation we've done before. It's an extremely powerful healing meditation. And as you do your visualizations for yourself individually, for your community locally, for the District of Criminals, especially going out across our nation, across the continents, and across our world, connect with your family, your brothers and sisters that are in the ships preparing to meet with us here, and take the energy of this gigantic burst of love that's coming through. Take it into your body and ground it into Mother Earth and thank her for healing now. Thank you. And I want to share with you a little bit about Noble Drew Ali. So just to remind ones who are new to this, let me bring up that page on the Galactic Roundtable. What I did today was I embedded an entire book onto the front page of the Galactic Roundtable that was written by Noble Drew Ali. And this is available on the internet for free. And just to make it simpler, I made a hot link, and if you just press the button, you'll be reading a book he wrote. So remember, Noble Drew Ali is the father of Queen Elizabeth II, and he is a prophet. And then, if we look at the history of the Moorish Science Temple of America, we'll see that his successor, when Noble Drew Ali passed, then his successor was Wallace Fard Muhammad and Elijah Muhammad, who was Fard's successor, and he was the one who Malcolm X worked with. Malcolm X worked closely with Elijah Muhammad, and Malcolm X is the father of Barack Obama. So the prophet Noble Drew Ali is the father of Queen Elizabeth II, and he founded the Moorish Science Temple of America. And the ones who successed him in that endeavor were Wallace Fard Muhammad and Elijah Muhammad, and Malcolm X worked with Elijah Muhammad, and he is President Obama's father. So now you see that thread. And many like to say that Noble Drew Ali was following a sect of Islam. And if you study his teachings, you will see that he was incorporating Islamism, Buddhism, Christianity, Freemasonry, Gnosticism, and Taoism in his works, in his writings. And this was a true master. And he wrote a book, and it is called, I want to get it right, the name, he wrote several books. Okay, hold on, I'm just getting to it. Okay, let me look on the front page of the round table. 1 second. The name of the book he wrote, Noble Drew Ali, is called The Holy Quran of the Moorish Science Temple of America. And if you go to the front page of the galacticroundtable.com, you're going to find, scroll down past the blog section and above the videos, and you're going to see a picture of Noble Drew Ali, and you're going to see a picture of Malcolm X on the day he met Martin Luther King in Washington, D.C. on March 26, 1964. And the Holy Quran of the Moorish Science Temple of America, the table of contents is there. And as you read through it, a portion of the book is dedicated to the works of Jesus. It's a very interesting book. And there's a hot link there that you can click on, and it will bring up the whole book for you. So I encourage everybody, please read it. And I want to share a few words. This was written about the prophet Noble Drew Ali. Read and compare the teachings of Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, and Confucius, and encourage your inner being to develop seeing a pattern of oneness of the ancient wisdom teachings. Despite where you are today in your level of consciousness, your level of light and love held within your being, truth is truth, and whole is whole. The universal wisdom from the Moorish Holy Quran is used to display the universality of the teachings of Noble Drew Ali. As he states in the Moorish Holy Quran, truth is the only thing that changes not. All of the ancient and sacred scripture, Suhuf Ir Ibrahim, the Pure Pages, Torah, 5 Books of Moses, Az-Zabur, Book of Psalms, Al-Hikmah, Book of Wisdom, Al-Injil, Gospel, Revelations, and Al-Quran act as a guide, science, and gateway to the many and one universes of higher intelligence that serve Allah. Allah is a beautiful word. It means goddess. And I like to use the phrase all that is. The ancient scriptures are the revealed science of light that work in direct service to the hierarchies and theophanies of Aht within all that is continuum. With great and intense study, the adept of the sacred scriptures of light is translated into the higher thought frequencies, where she or he is uploaded with the knowledge, wisdom, and discernment of the heavenly codes that are to be transmitted to the other Asiatic creations. and it says, Moors, study everything and all aspects of life as everything is everything and everything is of the essence of Goddess. So that's my gift to you this week. Please read the book. It's fantastic. So if everyone wants to get comfortable now, the equinox will be happening in 12 minutes, so we will literally be in the middle of it while we're doing our meditation. This meditation is with Lord Sananda and Mother Sekhmet. And Lord Sananda channeled this meditation to me. I wrote what he said and I recorded it. And since I've had my excitement tonight and I'm a little tired, I'm going to go ahead and play the recording for us so I can be meditating too. And let's raise the vibration of Mother Gia Gaia. And in her healing, we welcome our family back. Right after the meditation, I'm going to take us into a kirtan, which is a kind of chant. And it's wonderful to get into it. If you're a guy, sing the guy part. And if you're a girl, sing the girl part. It's a lot of fun. And it will really raise your vibration after this meditation, which is an invitation from Mother Sekhmet to heal all that needs healing now as we go into the changeover. Thank you, everybody.
Hi, everybody. You are listening to the 2009 12-12 Meditation, presented by Mark Huber and Beth Trutwin. Please share this with as many as you can, and please visit our website at www.galacticroundtable.com. This is the voice of Admiral Sananda Kumara. Please use this meditation as often as you like. Begin by taking some clearing breaths. Feel yourself begin to relax. We call together all the beings of light as we embark on this journey. Please close your eyes and feel the third eye between your brows open up. Imagine a multi-petaled lotus blossom opening up and up and up. Go deeper into the center of the flower, and as each petal blossoms, see light flowing out of the petals. Now feel your crown chakra opening at the top of your head. Feel the crown dilating, and the crown opens wide. It is a launch pad to the dimension of formless form. When you see inside the open crown, there is a spacecraft waiting for you, and beyond is the blinding light of the antimatter universe. We are leaving our Earth bodies behind just for a very short time, and we are safely flying together in this craft past the 13th gateway from matter to antimatter. As we enter this space, we see light and more light. We zoom up, up, up through the dimensions, and we come to a pyramid temple. The sunlight here is very bright and feels warm and pleasant. We now walk inside the pyramid. When we go inside, we see we are standing on a crystal which is made of light. There are rainbow light colors reflecting off this crystal in the floor and projecting rainbow colored rays on the walls of the pyramid inside. We are all standing there and smiling, enjoying the beautiful light, and some notice the gentle angel song. Now look up into the apex of the pyramid temple and see there is another crystal, which is the capstone of the pyramid. This crystal, which is made of light, has many facets, and there is sunlight pouring through the capstone onto the floor. There is brilliant, bright sunlight flooding this place and connecting with the rainbow light which is in the floor. We all bask in this light together. This pyramid temple is a portal of creation. We come here together to amplify the 1212 Stargate love portal of light and love sent to Earth now. We begin by welcoming Mother Sekhmet to join us here. She has requested we join here now, so any who desire this may have a healing session with her. All you must do is ask and allow. She will facilitate this healing for you. Feel Mother Sekhmet reach down into your core. She can do this for everyone at once. See her paw reaching deep, deep down inside of you and taking hold of your core fear. As she holds it, she finds the very origin of it and cuts it out and removes it. She lovingly releases your core fear to the void beyond the void, and it returns to source. Your core fear is now gone. It is dissolved, and you are free to become a new you. When we leave this place, you are free, and you need not carry that with you anymore. Thank you, Mother Sekhmet. We love you. She wrinkles her nose, smiling and blessing us, each one. As we breathe in and relax deeper now, we join our thoughts together. There is love flowing from one heart to the next and on out back to Earth. We breathe in love into the threefold flame of our heart. With this, we feel a new reverence for all life in the trifold flame of our solar heart. With deep gratitude, we join with Saint Germain, Sunat Kumara, Ashtar and their twin flames, and all the Kumaras, as we experience the violet flame going out over all of Earth. We now experience the oneness with all that is, and we become love, and we attract to ourselves and into our lives and the life of every living being. Love, wisdom, bliss, abundance, enlightenment, eternal peace, harmony, balance, and joy. We carry these attributes, and with them, we find our own path on the master plan. With these attributes, we co-create a consensus reality of Terra Nova. Mother Sekhmet is here with us now. From her is flowing the divine love from Mother God. It is flowing freely to each one of us. As we reach up and stretch to greater service, we grasp higher the majestic force of love flowing from her and into our lives. We embrace this sacred knowledge and we ask she teach us how to share this love in service to each other. It is with this love we co-create a new world together. We create here in this sacred place with all our brothers and sisters of light and in all the hearts of humanity. Peace, awakening, empowerment, unity, and more love. We join together to return to Earth. We are healed, restored, balanced, and ready to move forward in love. When we return from the place we have left, we return to see all of Earth is flooded with light and flooded with love. She is new, and we now remember our true identity, and we love being on Terra Nova together. With our solar heart flames blazing, we go forward with divine gratitude for what we have accomplished together. And so it is now. Admiral Sananda Kumara. This is a gift brought by Beth and Mark, and we hope you will join us on BBC, bbsradio.com.
Enjoy the kirtan, everybody. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody, continue to relax. I want to read to you what James Tiberon has to say about this fall equinox tonight. The omnipotent Om wave. This is from Earth Keepers about the equinox global. The Cosmic Council of Light are gathering. Saint Germain and the Ascended Masters of the Cosmic Council of Light are again gathering en masse between the period of September 20th and 25th. We've been watching this every night taking place in the Himalayas. Anchored in Mount Shasta, the energies of the Council will be here to assist humanity in the second Om wave of the exceptionally potent September equinox of 2010 occurring tonight. The equinox occurs at 3:09 a.m. on September 23rd in London, Universal Time, and in North America on the night of Wednesday, September 22nd, at 11:09 Eastern, 10:09 Central, 9:09 Mountain, and 8:09 Pacific. And if you're not near a clock, that was 10 minutes ago while we were meditating. Thank you. Tonight's equinox is indeed the gateway of the 10-10-10. It opens the energy beyond the scope of an ordinary equinox. This date has three major power influences: the equinox, the full harvest moon, and an extraordinary Jupiter opposition. Remember, Jupiter is the fourth sun with the sun Sol, Sirius A, and Sirius B. The fourth sun in our solar system is Jupiter. We cordially invite you to join the family of Earth Keepers in a meditation on the equinox. We joined with their group tonight. We will conduct a global Om wave meditation, inviting in the Cosmic Council of Light with Saint Germain and the Ascended Masters. There will also be an opening in the energy of the sacred dolphins and whales of Sirius B. Earth Keeper will present the gateway 10-10-10 on the equinox. In the global meditation, we will participate with the Cosmic Council of Light, Saint Germain and the Ascended Masters, and sacred dolphins and whales of Sirius in co-sending in omnipotent wave of crystalline energy intoning the sacred Om. That's why we sang the kirtan, Om Namah Shivaya. The Om energy will surround the planet and envelop all of humanity and the earth and cosmos in the resonance and sacred heart energy of unconditional love. We cordially invite each of you to share this message and join us on the equinox. The Om energy of this wave will be for the highest good of mankind, of the earth, and the sacred cosmos as the earth and humanity take the benevolent graduation into the next step of ascension, the crystalline transformation and crystalline light body. Thank you, everybody. I pass the talking stick.
Hello.
Hello.
That was awesome.
You are welcome. Thank you for being here with me.
Indeed. I will just say what you were reading about, what the commander is speaking about in terms of the master showing up there in the Himalayas. There's no accident. The white tigers are also there. Mm-hmm. And our friends from Pleiades are there.
Mm-hmm.
let's just say that the mother has taken her hand or paw off the second hand and it is ticking now. And I'll just say, you know, like she says, that train, you don't want to miss that train. It is, oh my God.
We're in process now.
Yes.
We are in process.
That is right.
What is it you say, Rama? You're going to set something to center, heart, core of the universe and full speed ahead.
Oh my.
You say it better than I do.
I think it's a little late for Jefferson Starship.
It's never too late for Jefferson Starship.
I agree, yet we're in a neighborhood where we gotta kind of keep it cool.
What is cooler than that? Come on. I'll bring out tribal version of We Are Family.
Please.
You all need to relax and have some fun sometimes.
Yeah, chill, huh?
Right.
Yes, it is so hot in the kitchen. I would just say the issues at hand are what the commander there, James Tiburon, is saying. In the understanding, Jupiter is our fourth sun, and it's only now being talked about in that sense. And it's an interesting place because you have to go there in your etheric light body. You cannot go there in the physical. And it has to do with the energy waves of the planet because it's in the etheric. Jupiter is in the etheric, even though it appears in the physical. And a lot of folks don't understand that piece. And one time I tried to go there, and I was told I have to go in my light body.
One time I went there in my light body, and I stayed for an hour and a half, and it was so hard to hold the energy, and it felt like this, for an hour and a half, I sat in the chair like that, and I didn't want to leave, and I could barely hold the energy to stay, and I didn't want to. It was hard to stay, and I didn't want to leave. And it was this energy that there's no way to describe it. And you know that you're sitting on a sun. And there were ships there, and there were people there. And
yes, Jupiter has this, you know, an intergalactic civilization that's part of the family of the people of Telos. Along with the moons surrounding Jupiter. Ganymede is one of the planets or moons that a lot of the ships of the people of Telos are in stasis, if you will. The ships are living beings as well as, you know, ships.
Right.
Yeah. And
some of the ships I saw were really, 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 really big.
They are huge in the sense where 2 million is a complement of the crew on one of those ships.
That's what it looked like. And you know what else it looked like a little bit?
Yes.
To me, it looked a little bit like the Jetsons because people were like shooting around in their ships and they were all congregated around this one spot and they were hanging out like that. And it just reminded me of the Jetsons.
Sometimes the beings appear to move like that because it is about, you know, they're moving at the speed of light. We're catching up to that.
I think it felt like kind of like fun, like the Jetsons. It felt light there. Everybody was happy.
Uh-huh.
And you're sitting there watching this, and that's why you don't want to leave, and you can barely stay because you have to get so fast to get there.
Oh, yes. It is. One time I went to, I think it was our Antares Arcturus Midway station, and I got on this conveyor belt, and it was like this belt of light that took me to the center of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I was unfamiliar with the city, and I just, you know, hopped on, and then it was like I didn't recognize any of the places that I knew I could remember. And then I started asking questions at that part of the city, and they said, you're not in the right part of the city.
Mm.
Yeah. And I had to go through a series of different light bands to get to the right part of the city, which was quite a dance, you know. It, you could say it was like doing the freeways of L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not sure where to go with this.
I don't know.
I mean, I can play that second hour of Red Ice.
That would be so great.
Okay.
You have to tell people again what it is.
Oh, all right. This is this man who has been doing research in schizophrenia, and he's a psychiatrist, psychologist. Rick Strassman, Inner Past, Outer Space, and the Soul of Prophecy.
Mm.
And he's been working with DMT, which is in ayahuasca, and what he's been having experiences with folks are when they have gone on these journeys, some of them have been in hospitals and they have met the Galactics on their journeys. And, you know, how is that possible? Yet what I'm trying to say is that it's at the place where once you step out of this, you know, it just is. And what you know, what I'm saying is that he is talking about how we go into the noggle at the spirit molecule where, you go to the size of a particle and you travel with mother as all the particles that are part of the balls of light from whence we came. And it's kind of interesting because the few substances on this planet that take you to that level is, it seems that the medical profession would rather you not find out about these things because they open up the noggle so that you can have full recall of who and what you are. And they don't want us to remember that, yet that's starting to shift as we are discussing this right now. The spirit world is this world. And what I am saying is that not everything appears to be as it seems because the matrix is falling apart. As we do what we have to do to heal these bodies and come into the understanding that we are God beings, like all the movies and prophecies and stories talk about, that what Cynthia explains is that we are gods and goddesses, just like Heru, Horus, and his brother Seth, as well as all the other stories about Isis and Osiris and Ra and Mother. This is family, and yes, if you wanted to play, we are. And I'm just saying that in that sense of the understanding here, it seems...
One tribe, one land. I'm just being me.
I know.
It's a tongue-in-cheek joke. It's both.
It's cool, Lady Master. I'm just saying how we get there. One of my spiritual teachers, Swami Satchidananda, he said, truth is one, paths are many. And how you get there, we're all
here. With love.
With love. We're all here. And what I'm saying is that this man, Rick Strassman, is giving some answers to questions in a sense that are not being answered by our medical profession for sometimes issues that have to heal the soul. And the only way to do that is to go on a journey and talk to your spirit guides and the ascended masters and the galactics. And who else is going to take you there but a shaman, not a doctor in a hospital. And this is why this stuff doesn't get talked about, because witch doctors... This is, you know, I bring up President Aristide because he was a doctor in this spirituality with the voodoo of Haiti, and that was a good thing. And they don't want these wisdoms to come out because it takes us to the level where we got our power back, and God forbid. Yet I'll go ahead and play this.
Did you read it?
No. In our next hour,
this is Rick Strassman, From Inner Path to Outer Space and the Soul of Prophecy. And this is the second hour. We played the first hour a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And so it's, yeah, go ahead.
In our next hour, we discuss visionary experiences with DMT, the spirit world, and spiritual journeys. We also talk about positive and negative effects with this compound and the link, if any, to schizophrenia. We move further into the area of theology and religion to try to understand prophecy and people having visions from this point of view, seeing angels or demons, or aliens, for that matter, could be related to DMT. We also talk about the soul of prophecy and Old Testament characters, their visions, prophecies, and compare to other examples like the Oracle at Delphi. Visionary experiences of DMT, spiritual experiences, all kinds of wild stuff.
Spiritual experiences, yeah, the spirit world, positive and negative experiences. Okay, we can go on. Then who is in psychology? Okay, ready? How long is it actually?
I think it's about 52, it's an hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that okay? We ready, Beth?
Yeah, when we finish up, we're going to be about one song away from wrapping up the program, and thank you so much.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Welcome, Rags members. to ask you, I guess, a bit of a, more of a personal question. If you tried DMT yourself, and if so, if you would say that you have had a similar experience as your test subjects did with.
Oh, you know, I'm kind of cautious about talking about my own drug use, obviously, as this might be. I have taken ayahuasca, though, you know, within legal settings, both in Brazil and in the U.S. You know, there's a couple of, you know, churches in the States that came in from Brazil, which have got, you know, legal, you know, permission to use ayahuasca in their ceremonies. And I've attended, you know, a couple of those in the States, as well as one in Brazil. It seems like ayahuasca, you know, and the DMT that's contained therein, at least in terms of, you know, my experience, it caused quite similar visions and effects, you know, to those that my volunteers describe. You know, obviously over a longer time course, ayahuasca, you know, begins to work in about an hour and peaks in about, you know, 2 hours and is over in around 4 hours as compared, you know, to the whole experience with IV DMT being over in 20 minutes or 30 minutes. But, you know, qualitatively, it seemed quite, you know, similar to the effects reported by my volunteers.
Well, that's very, very interesting, obviously. But why do you think then that the experiences are so similar? Are we really tapping into the true spirit world from beyond here in that sense? Or is it the way that we all interpret these kinds of substances because we have a similar, you know, neural network in terms of the brain? Or what do you think it is?
Oh, I think to, you know, a certain extent, it is dependent on the specific drug, you know, which is being ingested. You know, DMT is, you know, obviously the drug I gave our volunteers, and, you know, DMT is the visionary ingredient in ayahuasca. You know, so it isn't surprising, you know, that the effect of IV DMT and of ayahuasca are quite similar, you know, other than the time course. And, you know, there are other, you know, naturally occurring hallucinogens like there. You know, 5-methoxy-DMT, for example, is a chemical cousin of DMT. And it occurs in plants, it occurs in humans, it's extremely, you know, short acting. As compared, you know, to the more, you know, visionary and, you know, visual responses to DMT, most people who ingest, you know, 5-methoxy DMT describe a more of a unitive merging with the light kind of experience, you know, more typical of, you know, the end point of an NDE or a Buddhist enlightenment, you know, than is the case with DMT.
Right. And do you think then that, you know, could this be an explanation for a spiritual experience? You mentioned before that if we're looking at a scenario where we don't obviously take more DMT that is naturally already occurring in the body through external means, possibly things like stress could release some of this as well. But I mean, we have a lot of people out there who have various random, just heightened spiritual experiences. Could this
right.
be an explanation for that, do you think? That all of a sudden it might strike somebody for whatever reason. It might be even a chemical imbalance maybe in the body or in the brain, which releases more DMT than normal. And hence you have an incredible, strange and spiritual effect out of this. What do you think, Rick?
That makes sense. And, you know, the schizophrenia research, which occurred in the 60s with DMT, you know, kind of pointed in, you know, that direction. You know, if you would study schizophrenics, you know, their concentrations of DMT in their urine would seem to increase corresponding, to the intensity of their psychotic symptoms. You know, so that was, you know, some evidence in, you know, support of a DMT, you know, role in, you know, naturally occurring altered states, which were more, you know, pathological in, you know, nature. In other words, you know, psychosis or schizophrenia. Lower animals, increases concentration of DMT occur in animals if they're stressed as well. You know, so there is, you know, some circumstantial evidence, you know pointing to a stress-induced release of DMT. You know, that's not been established in, you know, normal people yet, you know, but it has been established in lower animals and in, you know, people with psychosis. But, you know, it would make sense if stress, you know, causes in some people DMT-like experiences without, you know, giving them DMT. You know, to the extent, you know, that the two, you know, syndromes resemble each other, there's got to be, you know, something endogenously happening at the same time.
Absolutely. And, I mean, you described also as well, obviously, in terms of your the volunteers that you tested on, it was various responses. I think, if I remember correctly, primarily there was positive response and positive experiences that came out of it, but not here and there. There was also some negative experiences, not only with some of these entities, but overall there were more shock and things like that. Can you talk about that a little bit? What was some of the negative effects that people had with this?
Yeah, you know, well, that was another reason, or, you know, that was one of the reasons that I described earlier about only studying experienced psychedelic users. I was, you know, concerned with them being able to handle the intensity of the DMT effect. You know, nearly everyone, when the effect first began, were anxious, just because they were so fast and so intense. But, you know, as a result of the volunteers' experience, and also quite a few of them were experienced in different forms of, you know, meditation and, you know, concentration practices, and so they could stay, you know, focused without panicking, you know, any more than they needed to. You know, so after the initial, you know, disorientation of the first few seconds, you know, most people, you know, could regain their balance and, you know, were able, you know, to observe the effects with a clear mind and without, you know, too much anxiety. You know, some people panicked, though, in you know, the very beginning. And, you know, they never got back on their feet. And, you know, those people, you know, for those people, the experience was extremely tumultuous and anxiety-provoking and, you know, frankly, horrible. You know, and, you know, that's another reason why we chose DMT, you know, too, because the effects are over so quickly, I was thinking.
Right.
If somebody was having a bad time, it would, you know, be over in a matter of minutes.
And if we talk about people from the ancient world, or not that many years ago, really, and still occurring in this day, of course, we have people witnessing both angels and demons, various visions. And if we look at it in the modern perspective, people are having alien experiences as well, of course, everything from abductions to encounters with weird creatures, and they seem to be dreamlike in some cases, and in some cases they seem to be more vivid and real. And obviously, as all things are, we might be looking at a scenario where we have multiple things going on. But do you think, personally, that one of the explanations for a few of these reports and accounts could be a similar experience, natural release of DMT in the body, do you think?
Yeah. Well, you know, that makes sense. You know, to the extent that people's reports, you know, from history, or even, you know, recent history, or even, you know, from biblical history, you know, describe, you know, phenomena that resemble those DMT volunteers report, you know, you'd have to, you would need to posit, you know, some, you know, fundamentally similar biological phenomena taking place.
And so why don't we get in and talk a little bit about the new book that you're working on currently. Rick, give us a little bit of an outline, and how far have you come? Is there still a lot of work to do, and what is the main kind of outline of the book?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time, and I guess I'm still spending time, but, you know, it's a little clearer now in terms of the route that I'm pursuing, but, you know, after I completed the work in 1995, I really had to kind of go back to the drawing board with respect to coming up, you know, with a model, you know, for the DMT effect. You know, from the spiritual point of view, I was approaching it, you know, from the perspective of Zen Buddhism. I had been a practitioner of, you know, Zen for many years. I was a ordained as a layman within the order, you know, helped establish a meditation group in Sacramento, you know, spent a lot of time at the monastery, you know, so on and so forth. You know, the spiritual, you know, lens that I was, you know, kind of, you know, viewing the effects I was expecting in the DMT, you know, studies, you know, was the Buddhist perspective, especially that of Zen, which tends towards the unitive and the mystical, non-verbal, you know, non-conceptual experience of enlightenment or, you know, kensho in the Japanese, language. You know, like the ego would be gone, there wouldn't be any concepts, you know, there'd be no individuality, you know, would be the merging and the complete identification of, you know, the individual and of, you know, the Godhead or, you know, the source of all being or, you know, the Buddha nature or, you know, whatever, you know, term you want to use. But instead of that, you know, the volunteers reported, you know, that they kept their individual integrity, you know, they continued to observe things. It seemed external as opposed to internal or even internally generated. You know, there was a relationship, there was correspondence, there was communication. You know, among the 60 volunteers that got a high dose of DMT, I would say maybe one or two, you know, had the kinds of enlightenment experiences, that I was anticipating would be the norm. You know, so that was confusing for me. It didn't comport with, you know, the hypotheses that I, you know, went into the study with. You know, so after the, you know, research ended in 1995, and I, you know, began to entertain, you know, various, you know, theories as to what was going on with the volunteers, and what was the nature of the DMT world, I entertained, you know, a number of different hypotheses or, you know, models. You know, one of them obviously is the brain chemistry model. You know, it's only your brain. That's okay as far as it goes, but it doesn't really look at the implications of, you know, why the brain is designed that way. What is the nature of the information in the states? So I was then, you know, kind of approaching it, you know, from the more psychological point of view, from the classic, the Jungian point of view or the perspective of the Freudian schools. You know, but those, you know, really didn't, those were, you know, kind of, you know, looking at it from the perspective of individual, you know, psychology, as it were, which also, you know, wasn't all that gratifying or all that interesting to me. Didn't take into account, the full spectrum of, you know, the effects. So then I began to look at, some of the theories out there in contemporary, you know, physics, like, you know, parallel universes, dark, you know, matter, explanations for, you know, external freestanding, you know, non-visible, you know, levels of, you know, reality that we can't perceive, you know, sometimes, in the case of contemporary, you know, physics, we're able to view these incorporeal states or invisible worlds through instrumentation. So it also seems, you know, that the brain is obviously a more, complex machine than anything, that we've been able to design so far. So it made sense to me that perhaps, DMT is retuning the brain or, you know, the receiving characteristics of the brain to be able, you know, to perceive these, you know, non-visible, you know, levels of existence, which people are, you know, currently, you know, calling, you know, parallel universes or dark matter. You know, but those, you know, really didn't, explicate the message of those worlds. you know, I suppose, you know, they could help explicate, you know, the mechanisms of action or, you know, how we get into them. But, you know, why is it designed that way? And, you know, most importantly, you know, what's the information that's in there?
Yeah.
Is it important information? You know, what can we do with it? So, you know, I then, you know, kind of ended, you know, the DMT book and, you know, kind of my contribution to the Inner Path book as well by just, you know, kind of in a, you know, most generic, you know, kind of way saying, well, I think, you know, the jury's out, but if I had to vote, I would say there's spiritual, you know, phenomena which can be described in any number of ways. And I guess by spiritual, I meant, you know, I'm invisible, you know, mostly I'm invisible, you know, to most of us, most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that came, you know, incredibly compelling information, which, we aren't able to access very often, and which I've got import to our everyday lives. You know, the emotions are intense, you know, the perceptions are unusual. But, you know, I didn't quite, you know, make a firm stand as to, you know, my belief in, I guess, just, you know, some of the more, you know, typical trappings of what you would call spirituality, especially if you're looking at it from the point of view of, you know, the organized religions out there.
Mm-hmm.
I examined Buddhism in my books that just, you know, pointed out, you know, that there was a striking difference between, you know, the expectations that I went into my study with using a Zen Buddhist perspective and, you know, the data, you know, from the research.
And so what was the difference there in that sense then, would you say? Do you think that your own outlook is also depending on the results that you're getting in that sense? That with your particular perspective, you're actually getting another relationship with the data in a way that is presented. Would you say that that's the case here?
Well, the whole issue of, you know, Buddhism and, you know, psychedelics is, you know, it's a huge topic. You know, almost every Western Buddhist, you know, out there got their interest in you know, Buddhism kindled, as a result of a, you know, psychedelic experience. You know, there are quite a few, you know, contemporary, Buddhists who are devout and, you know, good practitioners who occasionally still use a, you know, psychedelic, you know, drug to, you know, supercharge or amplify or, you know, solidify the practices.
Mm.
You know, so it isn't spoken of, you know, that much within, you know, traditional Buddhism, but it still is going on, you know, behind the scenes. At the same time though, you know, my Zen community, was extremely uncomfortable in any, you know, discussion, you know, that contained, you know, the words, you know, psychedelics and, you know, Buddhist practice.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And, you know, so we ended, you know, so we ended up, you know, parting ways as a result of, I suppose, you know, hegemony or, you know, turf wars over, you know, what's okay to talk about in the same discussion and, you know, what's off limits. As a result though, of, you know, taking a break, you know, from my Zen community, is that it, you know, gave me the opportunity to turn to, you know, back to my own roots. You know, I was raised Jewish, you know, my parents were Jewish as a kid, I had a Jewish education. I was, thinking, well, gee, you know, I wonder what's in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, there anything in there that may help explicate, you know, the DMT work? And, you know, I'm, you know, not a member of any specific, you know, Jewish community, or, you know, I'll have a rabbi who's gonna tell me what to think or, you know, to say or to write.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I was able to, you know, come to the Bible, you know, with a lot more of a, you know, unbiased and unburdened perspective. Also, I could come at it from the point of view of, you know, having done the psychedelic research and also, you know, having gone through, you know, decades of Zen practice. So, I, you know, began looking at the Bible. And, you know, I was interested in a couple of questions. You know, is, you know, the Bible a, you know, source of information about the state that my DMT volunteers underwent. You know, are there any overlap? And specifically, I was interested in the external freestanding, you know, nature of the spiritual or the, you know, the DMT, you know, world. You know, as opposed, you know, to the Buddhist or the brain chemistry or the psychological models that I had been dealing with. You know, I was convinced, or, you know, the volunteers were convinced anyway, that the DMT state was external to them. It was freestanding. It was going on at all times. They dipped into it and, you know, they dipped out of it.
Mm.
You know, so I was interested in, you know, if I could find a, you know, model of spirituality within the Bible that, you know, was consistent with the kinds of reports, you know, that the DMT, you know, volunteers spoke about. And, yeah, you know, so, as I was kind of revisiting the Bible, it was quite clear that, well, yes, specifically the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, it was clear that that was, you know, their model of spirituality. It was external, it was freestanding, you know, and, you know, people could dip into it. Or, you know, dip out of it, as the case may be. You know, so, those criteria were met, after, you know, I began to, you know, look into the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
Also, I was, extremely interested in the message of, you know, the psychedelic experience. You know, for most of the DMT volunteers, you know, they were coming at it, you know, also, you know, from a Buddhist perspective. Quite a few of them were, you know, Buddhist practitioners and also were expecting an enlightenment type of experience, you know, the merging with the white light. And it was confusing, you know, for them as well that was not the nature of their DMT effect. So they were a bit, confounded by it. They didn't, you know, come back with an extraordinarily well articulated, you know, vision of, you know, the content of, you know, the DMT experience. You know, they could more describe, you know, the images and the visions and the feelings, but in terms of the information itself, you know, they were kind of at a loss for words. So, as I was reading through the Old Testament, their concept of, you know, the prophetic state and of, you know, and of, you know, the person of the prophet and the prophetic message all, you know, began to kind of, you know, coalesce, you know, before me,
mm-hmm.
as, you know, reasonable models and an interesting concept to sort of, you know, frame these, you know, psychedelic experience within a, you know, more Western traditional model. And, you know, clearly the most important element of, you know, prophecy isn't the vision as such or the state of consciousness as such, which, you know, the Old Testament prophets underwent, but, you know, the message of, you know, the prophetic experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's, you know, kind of what I've been, you know, delving into, you know, for the last 10-15 years or so.
Oh, well, that is, I mean, it's a huge subject, and just, I mean, in passing, it's been kind of a, well, a one-way joke, I guess, in that sense, that the high priests, as it were, of old, Moses, etc., and some of the other biblical patriarchs, took some kind of psychedelic mushrooms. There's talk of mana and other things, of course, as well, in the Bible, and that the prophecies came out of that use of various hallucinogenic substances. But, I mean, just as an overarching idea, what you're saying, I guess, as well, then, is that there is indeed something to that idea, that there could be things that were going on in the ancient world that we have forgotten about today, and this might have been practices that were pretty common. I mean, we know about them, obviously, in the South American tradition and in the Siberian tradition in terms of shamans and mushrooms and things like that there as well, and in other cultures, but we don't think about it too much in the terms of the Middle Eastern/Western culture. But what you're saying is that there could indeed be something to this idea, and prophecy could be connected or at least related then to the phenomena of hallucinogenics. Is that what you're saying, Rick?
Well, people have speculated, regarding if, the prophets or Moses or, the Israelites in the desert, if, they actually, took in hallucinogenic compounds like mushrooms or ayahuasca-like ingredients. But, the whole issue of naturally occurring DMT in the human body, forestalls, kind of precludes, any dependence on, people taking in anything.
True.
If we're genetically wired, to be able to, synthesize, DMT in our bodies, then, then you don't, need to rely upon an external, source of those compounds.
That's absolutely right. And in terms of being predictive then, or talking about things that might happen in the future, but when we're in the realm of prophecy, and again, going back to your first book and tying this together with some of the stories that you had there with some of the subjects. In there, for instance, there is talk of encounters with bee-like beings and during certain sessions, some of the subjects were invited into what was known as, and you have this on your website as well, of course, if people can take a look at this, what was known as a hive of the future. And that sounds quite interesting.
Right.
And it was, this person was invited in, but he lost consciousness upon entering the death of the hive. What do you think that means? Is that predictive? Is that talking about something that is going to happen to humanity in the future? What do you think, Rick?
Well, that could be. So that kind of, leads us into defining prophecy itself. And I'm going to be taking a fairly broad view of defining prophecy. I'm just going to be speaking of it as a spiritual experience, which is attained in a prophetic state of consciousness, which has got features, which overlap with the state of consciousness, which is induced by a psychedelic drug, for example, DMT. The ancients or the medieval Jewish, philosophers define, prophecy as beholding God's glory. So the foretelling, aspect, spoken of, by the prophets, that's only one small aspect of, the prophetic state.
Mm.
And, that isn't really even, the reason for the, for the lasting impact of the writings of the prophets on the Western mind. The impact which has, lasted the longest, for the prophets isn't their predictions of the future, almost none of which have come true, but, more importantly, are, the ethical teachings and the moral teachings and, the teachings as, to the nature of the spiritual world and, the nature of God and, God's relationship to the world. So, those are the most, those are the most important, legacies, of the utterances of the Old Testament prophets who entered a prophetic state.
So,
in our volunteers, they weren't prepared, for the kinds of experiences, that they had. They were expecting experiences consistent with, their expectations, their own background, which were the more unitive mystical states. They were, psychologically sophisticated, but only to a point. I think ultimately the kinds of experiences that they had and the content and the form of their experiences were quite dependent on their, you know, level of ethical development, you know, psychological evolution, spiritual growth. You know, so even though I screened out people with obvious, you know, psychological problems, their everyday issues, the kinds of things they, concern themselves with on a daily basis, and those were the determinants of the content of their experiences. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you would think that if, somebody has spent their life, becoming as pure and as ethical and, selfless as, they possibly could be, then if, their brains were in, the exact same state as, somebody that isn't, as personally well developed, the nature of their experiences would differ. I mean, even though, the brain chemistry, was identical.
Right.
So the prophets were, they were a unique, group of people. Obviously everybody who, experiences a, psychedelic experience isn't a prophet. These were quite, striking, figures within their culture and, also within the context of even human history. So if their brains, for whatever reason, were under the influence of abnormally high levels of DMT, the contents of, their experiences would be similarly unique.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, again, if we look at it from the point of view of Western society with the laws that we currently have, some of the rights, I guess, in one way, that are given to people within society or civilization, whatever we want to call that, if that's built on the Bible with the connection to the Magna Carta and all that too, does that mean that these things, the laws, and again, ultimately the teachings then have been coming from another source, if you will, in that sense, not directly just the invention of human beings, but a source that is external to humanity? Are we talking about the same, do we need to go back to the same entities here, Rick, that we talked about earlier, that have influenced and then given instructions, informations to these people that were down in this region in the Middle East at that time? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think that's a crucial question. What is the basis of the law? Is it revealed? In other words, is it derived from spiritual experience, from spiritual entity, or from a spiritual level of reality, or is it arrived at purely through reason and thinking it's true? Spinoza is interesting, from that perspective. He spent his time, debunking any, relationship between the law and, revelation. But, at the same time, he speaks about the revealed, nature of the golden rule. That the golden rule couldn't really be derived, from logic. That it had to be a, divinely revealed, law. And, all of the Bible, and ultimately, I think all of, civil law, it revolves around the golden rule and, variations thereof.
Mm-hmm.
So, it also kind of raises, some questions about inner and outer as well. When you're, thinking about the brain being, programmed, for the psychedelic experience, that it's an experience, that is, that it is, laying latent in the brain. It also, if you want to extend your thinking along those lines, you could even be speaking about, that the message of, the psychedelic experience is similarly, latently and embedded, in the structure of the brain as well. So that begins to kind of you know, again, you know, kind of blur the boundaries between what's inner and what's outer. But, you know, I think it, you know, it's important to think about these things that, you know, can lead to some, you know, fascinating communications.
Would you say in one way that you're, this is an extension of some of the things that, well, I personally, for instance, have heard about Terence McKenna talking about the invention of language, pretty much, or he incorporates the entire human civilization, culture overall, as connected to hallucinogenics and the use of mushrooms and things like that. I mean, again, specifically, you come to, from the perspective that it doesn't necessarily then have to be an external source that you're using, because, you, again, DMT naturally occurring within the body, and you might have elevated levels of this for various reasons occurring naturally. But does that, do you mean, are you kind of building on from that in one way as well, that that's even, you know, civilization in that sense, and a lot of these ancient ideas that we still kind of operate by today, that, that they are coming from this, from another source, pretty much. I mean, in one way, humanity is being guided then in that sense, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I think so. Well, yeah, there's a, yeah, well, there are a number of points that you just made. You know, Terence's ideas are very important. And as you, you know, mentioned, you know, he's speaking about externally ingested compounds, but yeah, you know, the existence of internally generated compounds, you know, kind of, you know, forestalls any, you know, need, you know, to depend upon external agents. You know, these compounds, either externally ingested or internally generated, you know, being involved with the development of a spiritual worldview or language or consciousness, you know, I think that could certainly be the case. But I think also it's important to keep in mind, you know, the various loci of the phenomena. In other words, is it just the brain, or is the brain, you know, being reconfigured to be able to, you know, perceive things from the outside that it wasn't unable to perceive before?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think it's important to, you know, kind of be, you know, critical in your, you know, and, you know, differentiating, you know, cause and effect, as it were.
Absolutely. By the way, do you have a working title for this book as of yet?
Yeah, I have a working title. It's called The Soul of Prophecy, and the subtitle is called How It Works, What It Is, and Why It's Our Birthright.
Okay, and I mean we've seen examples from this in the past as well, with the Oracle at Delphi, for instance. It's been speculated now recently that this was also because of some of the natural occurring, I think even methane gases in the area or something like that from the caves. I can't remember exactly, but there is a story there in terms of how the visions that were given to some of these people were, because of, you know, an external, induced, hallucinogenic, substance pretty much, and the people, went into this state. The question of, I guess, in one way, is the validity of these things, though, in that sense, meaning what they're getting out of it, so to speak. Oh, again, I'm back to that question: are we entering, is humanity entering into the spirit world, and we're being getting contact with the great beyond, as it were, and it's from this world that we're being guided and given instructions, or is it just random? Is it just a hallucinogenic experience, and it's nothing really deeper meaning behind it, but it's our interpretation of the phenomena where we find something, we read more into it, if I put it that way, than actually is there. I don't know, do you have any comments on that, or anything you can touch upon in regards to that?
Well, yeah, you know, obviously we're kind of hitting upon some, you know, extremely deep questions. Well, you know, one of the interesting, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about a quote of Dennis McKenna's, you know, Terence's brother, when, you know, somebody, you know, was asking him about, oh, you know, isn't this just your brain on chemicals? You know, it isn't really spiritual. You didn't, you know, get it through hard work or through meditation or prayer or, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, so Dennis likes to say, it's all chemistry. Mm. It's all chemistry. we have bodies and we have brains and we have consciousness, and all of it, you know, is kind of connected, you know, to the body and ultimately the chemistry, and I guess ultimately the physics. But you know, at the more everyday level, it's, you know, chemically related. So, you know, I think it comes down, you know, to the issue of applicability and, you know, is it useful or not? Is it helpful or not?
Yeah.
You know, is the information that's coming, you know, through the pipe, going to help individuals? Is it going to help society? You know, those kinds of things. You know, so it, you know, kind of boils down to an ethical and, you know, moral applications of what's going on. You know, if we're, you know, when I started to think about, you know, the homeostatic, you know, nature of endogenous DMT transported into the brain to maintain a certain, you know, narrow, you know, window of, you know, perceptual consistency, and then started thinking, well, is this whole thing out here just, you know, like a hallucinated DMT trip? You know, would that make any difference in, you know, the way that I live my life? And I thought to myself, no, it really wouldn't make any difference because it's what's happening.
That's right. No, I agree with you, because I agree with Ben, is what he said there as well, in terms of, well, it's all chemistry, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily any less spiritual. It is, I mean, spirit is what you make it, what you see in a situation. I mean, if you come from a point of view that everything is dead and meaningless, then that is what it's going to be. If what we instill into the situation, or how we read it, I mean, it is spiritual if you want it to be spiritual. That's my view on it, anyway.
Yeah, and you know, there's still a cause and effect. You know, there's always going to be cause and effect. So, you know, and even in, you know, the DMT space, there's cause and effect. You know, so, you know, and, you know, it's a very important, you know, teaching within the Old Testament is, you know, cause and effect. You know, if you do things, then, you know, there's going to be consequences. So, you know, I think the whole thing is underpinned by cause and effect, which is going to be the case if you're hallucinating by DMT, or if, you know, this is, you know, something else. So, yeah, I think it, you know, depends on, your utilization, your application of, the states and the information that's contained there.
Absolutely. So what do you, how far have you come with the Soul of Prophecy, your new book? Are you wrapping things up, or is it still a long way to go?
Oh, I'm about a quarter of the way through. The first few chapters were just kind of a background as to, you know, like how I got from giving psychedelic, you know, drugs to becoming, you know, an amateur Bible scholar. I've written one, you know, I've written about four chapters out of the 12. I've been going through some personal losses the last 6 or 9 months. My mom died, my daughter died. Well, thank you. Yeah, and you know, and I've kind of hit a roadblock with the creativity part of things. But I'm continuing, you know, to gather up books and, you know, to read them. So you know, it's in my mind. I'm spending all of my time thinking about it, and I'm kind of conjecturing about what the next chapters are going to involve. So, you know, I think I'll get back to writing in the fall and hope to wrap it up probably, you know, 6 or 9 months after that. So, you know, hopefully, you know, by the end of next year, the book will be out.
Okay, that's encouraging, Rick. And but how is it in terms of some of the more esoteric branches of Jewish and Hebrew traditions? I mean, if we look at the Kabbalah, for instance, and other surrounding disciplines, as it were, in terms of spirituality that tries to explain the nature of reality and how things work and operate from that kind of esoteric point of view. Is that something that you have been looking at or plan to look at as well, as a possible, that these models that we have coming through from the ancient world, be those, the Kabbalah or the I Ching, even, or other things as well, that they might have their roots and origins in the same similar DMT-induced experiences as well?
I began to look into Kabbalah a bit, and you know, the Zohar, and you know, some of the other literature. But it's a huge field, Kabbalah, and it's a rabbinic invention, if you want to know my honest opinion. And it requires such an amazing amount of study and mastery of very complex concepts, and I think it's intended to keep people from from nosing around in some of the deeper implications of it's just clearly written in plain language in the Bible itself. So I think Kabbalah in a way is a way of fencing off some of the more esoteric information of the Bible. So I think it, and as a result of coming to that conclusion, which is probably pretty biased, but my conclusion is, I'm just going to stick with the Bible, the Old Testament. There's 24 books there. There's a lot of great minds that have applied themselves to understanding the language of the text, what it's actually saying. So I think there's plenty of information there. Even though it's over 20 books, it's only 24 books. It isn't hundreds of books like Kabbalah can be.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's going to be where I'm going to be kind of focus on it with this book. If the current book that I'm working on comes out in future editions, I think what I'll be including is the Christian views of prophecy and the Islamic views of prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right now I'm just kind of focusing on the Jewish views as explicated in the Old Testament, but there's obviously a huge amount of material in the New Testament and the Quran as well.
And as you're working with this, do you feel personally that there is validity to prophecy overall? And if so, I guess from your point of view also, then this would mean that this is not going to be restricted to the people that were participatory when the Old Testament was written, but maybe even be applicable to people alive today. What do you think?
As I described, or as I kind of allude to in the subtitle of the book, which is the birthright quality of the prophetic experience. If it is biologically, if the experience of the prophetic state is hardwired into us, it's only a matter of kind of tapping into it, either through practices or through psychedelics, but also at the same time, keeping in mind the importance of developing your personality and your soul and your psychology as best you can in other ways to make the most of your experiences that occur in altered states, then it is extremely applicable to the present day. In this book I'm working on, I hope to extend my audience out of the purely psychedelic brain chemistry group of readers that have been most interested in my work up to date by getting interested in this material, the religious right and the evangelicals and the fundamental Christians out there who understand prophecy from a certain point of view, from a scriptural point of view, perhaps not from the experiential point of view, which parenthetically they might be able to get a better handle on as a result of entering into altered states themselves, getting into some prophetic state of consciousness, and also another implication of some of the ideas I'm presenting is that is that people that are looking for a spiritual model to understand their, you know, psychedelic experiences through, you know, rather than, solely relying, solely relying upon the Buddhist or the pagan or, you know, the shamanic models, that they could also be turning to the Bible and, you know, the prophetic models. So spirituality as a means to integrate and understand their experiences.
Well, that's an interesting point, an important one too. There's obviously tons of spiritual traditions from around the world, and a lot of them seems to be talking about the same thing. I think that the problematic things that happen is when we have the interpretation of that material on a very, very detailed or not detailed, but a very, straight up kind of interpretation of it and not to look at these things from a spiritual point of view. We have a literal interpretation. That's the word I was looking for. A literal interpretation of these things. That's the one time when it can be kind of dodgy, as it is within all religions. But I think you're right, Ultimately, Rick. I think there's lessons and truths in so many things that have been coming to us from the ancient world, as it were.
It's important, as a result of, some of the ideas, that you just described, to read the Bible for yourself. As opposed to letting other people tell you what it says.
That's right. Absolutely right. Couldn't agree more. Rick, I think that this is a good place here to begin to round things up here for this time. I want to obviously mention your website again for those who want to know more about your work, rickstrassman.com, thespiritmolecule.com, and also poppinwoodresearch.org. We will have these linked up on redeyespatients.com, our website as well, of course. You can click through from our site easily. The books, again, then are called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. Then we have Inner Paths to Outer Space, and then also, of course, the Soul of Prophecy that we've been talking about here in our second hour, primarily about. It's been really interesting in having you on the program, Rick. We really enjoyed talking with you about your new and old material. We want to thank you for your time. Keep up the great work, and we hope that the new book comes out well, of course, as well. And will we have information about this up on your website once it's kind of beginning to wrap up and when it's ready to be released, Rick?
Yeah, I'll be keeping people current on progress of the book. I've been kind of, lax on my website. I guess it's just one man operation. It's hard to, kind of do everything at once. Some of my websites aren't quite as current as they could be, but as I get back to work on the prophecy book, I'll be, doing, my best to keep people updated.
Okay, very good. Excellent. Well, thank you again, Rick, for your time. Keep up the great work. We'd really appreciate having you here today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Rick Strassman. We say thank you to him for his time and to you for listening. We will be back with more on this subject soon with Mitchell Schultz, who is behind the upcoming film, The Spirit Molecule. Welcome to join us then. Take good care and thank you for being a member. All the best to you. Bye-bye.
Are we here?
The crickets are just wonderful outside. They're just, we have such a wonderful space here, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that. I really do. It was interesting what he said about the Kabbalah, but it's true there are just enormous amounts of studies that can be studied. about that material. Beth, are you still here? Did Beth go to another dimension?
I'm not sure.
Aloha, sister. We have a one, what time might it be here? Commander Beth calling Lady Master from the 144th dimension. What time might it be here? 10:33. What time is it now? Yeah, 10:33.
No, that's just mountain time.
Mountain, 12:33.
Yeah.
We have a half hour. What shall we do?
I have a song here.
Let's play a song. Let's do that.
Okay.
Okay, this is, which one?
Kashi Vishwanath Ganga.
By Krishnadas. Let's do that.
Nirvanarupam Vibhandhyatmakam Brahma Vedasvarupam Nityam Nirgunam Nirvikalpam Nireham Chitakashatmakashatvasam Bhajeham Nirakaramukar Mulam Turiyam Nirajnana Godi Nisham Nirisham Karalam Mahakala Kalam Kripalam Gunagara Samsara Param Natoham Rasaram Mahadeva Shambho Kashi Vishwanath Gange Rasaram Mahadeva Shambho Kashi Vishwanath Gange Rasaram Mahadeva Shambho Kashi Vishwanath Gange Rasaram Shambho, 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 Shambho
One more beautiful song from that little section here that I gave you a look up and down. I was going to just read this one section. This is another section of universal harmonics analysis. In a system, any change affects the whole. As the components change, so does the outcome. From the ground state of zero emerges the one, O-N-E, separating and changing components. Separation is what gives the individuality to consciousness in its many forms. Separation of white light into the rainbow spectrum of colors is what gives uniqueness to creation. For frequency differentiates from the undifferentiated source. Separation produces, listen to this sentence, three words. Separation produces relationship. Put that in our cap and think with our heart and feel that with our higher sense perception. From unity or I, or one, excuse me, duality occurs. Duality as mirrored aspect of self, capital S, enables separation or diversity of creation. Pick another one, please. Otherwise, unity could only replicate self. White light remains white light unless broken up into the various frequencies of color. You can turn that light on. Even numbers are considered yin or female principle. Odd numbers, even numbers are considered yin or female principle. Odd numbers, yang or male principle. Opposites enable form. Inside, outside, up, down, front, back, left, right, etc. From form comes volume. A square is symbolic of that physicality or earth. A square fleshed out becomes a cube. The divine becomes human. Capital D, capital H. A cube unfolded becomes a cross, a Celtic one. The cross represents to Christians the release of spirit from matter and return to source. Thus, great cathedrals were built as a cross with specific geometry. Square equals 81. We've been driving up and down 81 route all day and night, Marianne and Virginia. Interesting as it's thought, you know. And then we have 81. Oh, we didn't have that. We had that for Sundays with Marky. I just thought of it. Okay, square equals 81, as do the words unfolded, stored, beginning. Square equals 81, as do the words unfolded, stored, beginning. 81 equals 9 squared, or 9 squared, and they wrote it out, 9 to the power of the 2. I say that, 9 squared, right? Only, then they wrote it out, 9 squared, 2. 9 to the power of 2. As 1 is unity, 1 is unity, 8 the number of resurrection, capital R, or our musical octave. 1 octave is 8 notes. 111 is the sum of the word perfection. 111. 9 being the number of perfection. Love complete. 111 is also the sum of the word humanity. And the Greek word for Christ, Christos. The divine becomes human, capital D, capital H, so that the human may become divine, and the circle is unbroken. 111 is 3 times 37. 37 as sum of words being, words being, begin, 3 plus 7 equals 10. The number of the new beginning. New beginning equals 123. Begin anew equals 80, a creator. Knowledge of self, capital, small s, as self, capital S, mortal, and also the immortal, capital I, is to know oneself. As capital T, capital O, Z, 1. And also, capital T, capital W, Z, whole. All is whole. Whole may appear not to be whole, yet it's only an appearance as a whole, still remaining whole. The immortal I. Looked out through mortal eyes, observing and fashioning creation. The immortal eye looks out through, this immediate feedback to source, capital S, mother, informs the whole. Observation concentrates a point of awareness within the field of consciousness. Consciousness has come full circle from undifferentiated source to a particularized point of awareness within the whole. Observer, by distinguishing differences, is the pause in the continuous motion of consciousness. This critical analysis of what something is and is not may be the tension which maintains separation. This is true of my analysis method. 25 has definite components. A change in any component changes the quaternary as a whole. Everything is relative to the observer's now awareness. And there is only one observer. All of us. The one consciousness is source, all of us as mothers. Events and conclusions at capital S, capital E, capital C. A new kind of security and exchange, no, what is that SEC thing called? Isn't that the Security and Exchange Commission? A source, event, and conclusion commission of all order and design. Consciousness initiates, participates, differentiates, assimilates, and communicates all information in hyphen form the whole. Oneth of all and 11. 7 + 4 = 11. Equality. No separation. 704 = God. Apex, omega, point. 229, you go 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 there. Levels. 11 + 704 + 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Above the horizon, below the horizon, 111 = 100, and then below that, on the third line below, 0, source. This is one more thing here. Beginning and end, 1. That's what all of that means. I am the Alpha and the Omega. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. There is no God but Allah. Christ's prayer for our oneness with the Father. There is but one consciousness of which we are all composed. Quote, creation awaits with eager expectation the revealing of the Son of God. Unquote. And Rama has one more closing song, Aho Mitakuyasin. This is called Returning by Jennifer Berzon.
Aho.
Aho.
Thank you.
Returning home, and everybody, please push that $5 button. We need some of that, and we need help on our journey here. We need help to continue and also to prepare for some more bills and rent. And please, as you could email, Coran, K-O-R-A-N 999@comcast.net, and let us know as you put up this. And or you can send in the larger button in the PayPal to assist on the next. And let's just say a little prayer for anyone that's had any kind of concerns with health or spirit or issues or anything else. Ho'oponopono for the sake of the soul. Namaste. Thank you, Beth. Thank you, Mama. Beth,
thank you.
Are you one thing?
Thank you. Namaste, everybody.
Namaste.